At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello, everyone. Matt here. Just a quick intro from me on this particular podcast and the No Between the Sticks this week. You'll see from this pod that coming up is more of our Patreon chat with Rob Green. From what seems like an absolute eternity ago now during lockdown, the first half was posted on here back in December 2020. That was where we discussed his time with Norwich, with West Ham, a little bit of England in that too. This is the second half, starting with his move to QPR, and then eventually we'll post the extra time finale. The reason for this post is that we were due to release Between the Sticks and the previously discussed transfer special this week, but in what I guess you could call a Sky Sports breaking news-esque fashion, we'll say that unforeseen circumstances, scheduling circumstances, changed, which unfortunately meant we weren't able to record. So this is to just hopefully fill that void until we get back to recording properly next week and cover off some of the key talking points missed from the weekend just gone too, namely, of course, the return of Loris Karius in the Carabao Cup final. So yeah, that's all for now. Over to Rob Green. Enjoy. We'll move on to QPR, like we said at the top there. You eventually moved on to QPR. Some great times, bookended by some rather bizarre times. You were signed under Mark Hughes as what I imagine you presumed would be as a number one. You were number one, and then he goes and signs Julio Cesar. Talk to us about that whole situation.
Yeah, it was a really strange time, and you sort of haven't been at a club so long and lived and breathed that club to up and move. And it was an exciting proposition to go from sort of West Ham, where you're always in a fight against something or someone. It was always a bit of a soap or a drama, you know, that sort of thing, to go into somewhere where there was a well-respected manager, a chairman who was clearly sort of had ideas of building something, and you were kind of in it and had spoken to people and various, obviously, people within the club and said, yeah, let's do this, you know, great, great. And I was at the Euros whilst doing the medical, but did the medical, signed whilst I was over there, flew back, and they went, right, we want you in 5 days' time to fly to Malaysia. And I said, but I haven't had any time off. I finished the playoff final and go straight into the Euros. And so I got, we had a very small child, a 1-year-old. I think my son was one by then. And it was, you know, my wife was there going, You've been away for over like around 6 weeks or whatever it was to go to Euros, and now you've got a flight to Malaysia 5 days later. I mean, it was bonkers. So that lack of rest didn't help. That lack of just the intensity, the turmoil. You just got, you know, going from a playoff final into European Championships into moving was a lot to take on board. And then sort of obviously the club had ideas of where they were going and didn't really, in terms of signing Julio Cesar, and sort of you read about it, you hear about it, and sort of 2 or 3 games into the season, I was leaving to go to a game and Sky Sports News is on and I've seen Julio turning up at the ground to sign. And you're just like, you know, this is what, 3 hours before kickoff or whatever it might be, you're leaving for pre-match meal. And you're just walking up to the ground going, hold on a minute, what's going on? So we played the game and it was, I think, the next day or, you know, wherever I went into training, I turned to Mike Rigg, the director of football, and said, "What? Why have you signed me? What was the point in that?" And he said, yeah, in effect, we didn't really think that one through. You can leave. So it was a bizarre scenario. I actually had conversations with West Ham to try and go back there, and that didn't transpire. People, you know what it's like with goalkeepers, where you have a chain of moves that needs to happen, and you either And none of 99.9% of these chains of moves never come off. And you're always sat there and an agent will say, well, if he moves there, then he's moving there. Then he's basically, everyone's got their ducks in a row. It's where the first duck goes. But it's, yeah, it was really strange. And you just sort of one of them that you just sort of said, well, I made a decision at the time for the reasons that I made them. And it transpired to be different. So it was kind of, if you said, a mistake, well, the mistake is doing something in the knowledge of sort of the information that you have and you make the wrong choice. It wasn't the information that I had. So yeah, that was probably one of the most, I think that was probably the most difficult time I had in my career when I first went there and that happened.
Just touching on that, I mean, I can relate to, I had one similar example when I joined Brentford and the manager at the time. And I remember I was just about to play a game and one of my teammates said, oh, I hear we've signed Ben Hamer, who was, I think, at Reading at the time. And they'd loaned him and he was due to join the next day. And my way of dealing with it was having a blazing row with the manager there and then in front of the team just prior to the game, which in hindsight probably wasn't the wisest thing to do, but kind of got the job done in a weird way. Yes. But, you know, you kind of look back and these situations, how did you deal with that then? The moment that you found out, the fact they haven't come to you first, I guess, you've seen it by seeing it on Sky Sports News. How do you deal with that?
It's tough, you know. It's someone of such an ilk that you're there going, well, you can't really compete. You know, there's healthy competition where you're all fighting and whatever, but he's not coming to sit on the bench. You know, he's not moving his family over from Italy and Milan and he signed a 4-year deal, and he was the nicest guy you'd want to meet. Was Kello, my friend, came in, you know, like every morning, the first morning, just came up and completely diffused the situation. It was strange because we were in pre-season before he'd signed, and we're away, and there was the core of what was left of the English contingent of the UK, the originally UK based players, your Sean Derrys, your Clint Hills, Jamie Mackey, and Heidi Helgerson, they turned around to us going, no, you've got this one wrong. Yeah. And I was like, what do you mean? You know, what are you talking about? And they said, just wait, just watch what happens. And they didn't know that they were going to sign him, but they knew that something didn't sit right, you know, and it's cute, you know. The players are cute. They pick things up. They know the sort of the dynamics, especially experienced guys like that. They know the dynamics, and so it was really surreal, and it was really tough. I decided, you know, it was funny because having taken pelters after the 2010 World Cup with the media, you know, I realized that the focus was going to be on us, and the best way to deal with it is just sit tight, just sit there, sit on your hands, literally sit on the bench, do nothing. And the worst part was we played at home to West Ham and got beat, and I was sat on the bench and the whole of the West Ham fans were singing to me, and Andy Carroll was sat on the West Ham bench banging on the bench, screaming at me, banging on the plastic sheet, Greeny, like that. And we were 2-0 down, and I'm just sat there looking. And I knew there's a camera across the and he's pointing straight at me. And I'm directly behind Mark Hughes, and we're going through as a team, going through absolute turmoil. And I'm just like, I just burst out laughing. There was nothing. Oh, no, I've gone. He got to me. And it just kind of, from that point, it went downhill, and it was difficult. It was really tough. And on a personal level, I took consolation from the fact that, you know, I still had time on my side. This was a really bitter pill to swallow, but it was one where you say, well, there's nothing I can do. You know, I'll go in and train and just sit there and just wait. And that's all you can do at times, isn't it?
You mentioned Mark Hughes there, Rob. I thought, just from reading up on this, there were some rather ambiguous quotes at the time, it seemed. He pretty much said that he'd speak to you in good time. Like, certainly I will sit down with Rob and go through it. He also said, you know, if you were to ask to leave, he said it wasn't his concern, and that, you know, we have to make sure we're as strong as we possibly can be as a club. Did you have discussions with Mark Hughes?
Not to any great extent, Mark Hughes. Just sort of going on? You know, like it was that bemusing. You know, I've left one club where I was an established number one and just been the number two keeper for England at a European Championships to come to. At the time, you'd say they were sort of with the ambitions that QPR had and West Ham coming back up. They were on a par, maybe, you know, with loftier, probably unfounded ambitions. But and the signings that they were making, you were thinking it was kind of going to be one big thing. And you sat there saying, well, it's not like I've taken a massive step up or I've played in the Premier League before. I've proved myself in the Premier League before. Like I said, I'm with England. You're not signing me to not play me. And there wasn't really a great explanation. So it's kind of, you can't argue with apathy or ambiguity because you're just there. You just end up sort of, as you like Richard did, probably having a blazing row against a dummy. Not a dummy, but I'm not calling Mark Hughes a dummy, but you know, you may as well be in an empty room because he's just sitting there going, yeah, you're probably right. You know, you turn around and go, this is shit. What you think? Yeah, you're right. It is. Yeah, sorry about that. And it wasn't that sort of conversation. But if you like, it was a pointless exercise because they said, well, I spoke to, you know, I went to Mike Rigg and said the director of football and, you know, probably got shuffled into his direction rather than the manager's direction because he had enough. Sort of enough to deal with on his plate, but it was one that I explained. I said, talk me through your decision making process, and they said, well, we needed 22 players at the start of the season, two in every position, and that's what we've done. Got as many as we can in to start again, 22 players. I said, well, what about the dynamics of the team and the sort of the personalities and you know, have you done your due diligence in the type of characters people are? And yeah, we've not really had time to do that. And you just, like, literally, it was 22 pawns, get them, you know, put them in. And you were looking at some of the things that were going on, you're thinking, and this is what the lads who I still speak to now would say they saw before I came in.
Just incredible, isn't it, when you think of all those players as well that were brought in, I would imagine, on a pretty decent wage as well, the likes of Bosingwa and Ji-Sung Park and the lad from Madrid. Didn't someone come in from Madrid? I can't remember his name. Galeron or something. Was it Galeron? Something like that.
Oh, no, I can't remember. He's a really nice guy.
I love that you have this problem as well because I have this exact problem.
Yeah.
Which, yeah.
I tell you what, he was a sound as well. He came in and he was a proper footballer. And I can't remember his name.
Granero.
Esteban Granero. Yeah, of course. He was one of the guys, and you look at it and whether you had character, when I was saying about the right characters and stuff like that, he was sound and a good guy and a good footballer. And you look at the guys that you had coming in, Julio Cesar played for Inter Milan, probably never had to take a goal kick for 15 years. You know, a long kick, he'd just get the ball, roll it out. He came to keep, just genuine, was absolutely shattered at the end of a game just from the goal kicks. And, each one takes it out of you. When you're in the bottom of a league scrapping, you are used to taking 40 goal kicks long or something like that. He's walking off the pitch going, Robbie. What's going on? You know, what's this? I was like, yeah, this is called a relegation fight, mate. Yeah. Josep Bosingwa used to playing at Chelsea. Had a fallout with Harry Redknapp and Harry hung him out to dry a bit in the press, didn't he? Saying, oh, he earns this much a week, naming how much he earned a week. Mm-hmm. And the next day he came in and said, well, I'll tell you what, how many trophies has Harry Redknapp won and as a manager? I'm like, well, he won the FA Cup with Portsmouth. He says, yeah, I've won 16. I think it was 16 or 17 in my career. That's why I get paid what I get paid. But it was, you know, in his career, he'd never been at the other end of the table. There were guys there who'd never, and Esteban had been at Real Madrid. You know, not played nearly 100 games for Real Madrid, I think. But never been a focal point of the team, but always been in the team where you just go, right, you get the ball, do your thing, and the other team are going to defend. Jason Park is another one. You know, you sit there and you go, Jason Park, you've got to do this one job for the side. Yeah, and you've got a man mark, I don't know, Iniesta, Xavi, or someone, whoever it is. Oh, come to QBR, you've got to do four jobs as well on top of that one. So, it's you know, it wasn't, I think they sort of, whether it was desperation, whether it was just a lot of it was finding people, finding, you know, people of what you thought was the right CV, and it transpired that they just didn't fit, you know.
It's amazing that can happen. And again, I suppose I'm going to try and relate. And we had it once at Watford when Gianluca Vialli came in. You might remember this. Came in, manager of Watford, and recruited 12 to 15 players, all big names, like Ramon Vega, certainly for the Championship. I remember the classic quote was, we're the Manchester United of the Championship. I think we finished 14th, I think, that season. But the point is that so much of it is about the characters, because as you mentioned, there are certain players that fit certain clubs, that fit certain situations. We had the likes of Ramon Vega coming in, who within the first week was openly telling players that he was winding down, and this is a player that's on 10 times what most of the other lads were on. You can imagine instantly within the squad, you've just created a real problem. And so recruitment's one of the hardest things in football, but to kind of have that mindset of almost, well, if we get 15, 20 world-class players or world-class at one point, it's got to work. It just simply doesn't work. And I guess that was a good example during that period of time.
Absolutely. And I think it was... I think it's very difficult when you come in and you, as a manager and as a director of football, and you come in as a team, and to an extent, you've got to sell yourself, haven't you? Like, they phone you up and say, do you want the job? We're thinking of giving this manager the sack. We need to be Champions League in 4 years' time. We'll give you the resources. You're not going to say no, are you? And then you've got to act on it. And you can get this quandary of, well, if I get sacked in 6 months or 12 months and I haven't spent the money, what was the point in not spending the money? I may as well spend it now. So you learn off managers in they say, if you get given a budget, you spend 120% of that budget, because, you know, you're only saving it for the next guy. And you've never got as much power as when you first come in. Mm-hmm. So they would have said, right, let's keep us up. They stayed up on that incredible final day, didn't they? And then went, right, okay, let's get the broom out. Let's get to work. And they have a finite period of time. And it must have been, you know, and I think you end up trusting people, you end up trusting agents, you end up trusting people that you listen to that are sat there going, this is an easy gig. You know, I can get... So, you know, and you see the links over and over again with football, that certain players move with certain clubs because an agent gets used or whatever it is. It happens at every club all the time. So whether, you know, the best example, you're saying Alex Ferguson used to spend 18 months trying to find out whether he was the right character or not. You know, and that's for the best. So the rest of you are trying to catch up with that, which you can't.
As far as Mido, he gets one fly. What a save by Green, palmed away. Only as far as Chung Yung Lee, left side of the area, and again Green is there to the rescue. Brilliant block on the low ball in. Terrific work from a man who surely must be back in England contention.
I was going to say, just want to touch on that period of time. A goalkeeper coach that we share in common would have been Kevin Hitchcock. Yes. I'm guessing you'd have worked with that period of time. Huge for me personally. He actually came in. That was probably the one big positive for me during the Gianluca Vialli here, as he came in with him. He actually took me up to Blackburn with him. So I had a season up at Blackburn on loan with Hitchie. And, you know, I've got a lot to thank him for personally for my own career. How was your relationship with him?
Good. He came in at West Ham for a brief period.
Of course he did.
And with Gianfranco Zola, I'd had a long relationship with Ludo Miklosko there, who I loved very dearly and is a fantastic man. Hitchie came in and just went, right, okay, I just want to change some things in your game. And and I'm sure you know, he had a very good critical eye towards certain things, towards technique and stuff like that, and came up with new ideas. And there were certain instances at West Ham where, just in games, where I managed to go over and over again certain sort of step dive, changing the routine and the step dives, that sort of thing, that technique. And I think I made a save in a game, touched it onto the bike, bounced down, we broke and scored. Mm. And you think, and we won the game 3-2 when we were in a relegation fight. And you think, wow, okay, yeah, like that's about as good as it gets for a goalkeeper. And so little things stuck in my mind. I kept in communication with him, and we spoke throughout that summer, him being a West Ham fan as well. And he said, look, you know, bide your time, we'll get there eventually, we'll get there eventually. And then when that happened, that was when Julio came in, it was obviously really disappointing. Like, and it was to an extent out of his hands. He's a goalkeeper coach. He has a say, you know. And in all honesty, say, do you want, you know, a guy who's won this much in the world? Do you want to coach him? He's probably, yeah, all right. Yeah. So it was tough for him, because, and also, added to that, we had Radic Cherny, we had Brian McGovern, we had like 5 or 6 goalkeepers there. And if you've got that many, and the number one's sort of scrapping away in a relegation fight and is sort of a bit bewildered by walking into a team that's down the bottom of the league and can't get out of their own half, and you've got a number two who's unhappy about being at the club after just signing on the pretenses that he was going to say. You got a number three who thought he was going to be number two. You got a number four. There's not one happy sailor in the ship, so to speak. And it was really tough for Hitchy. And there was, not often, but like Murph would get upset about something in training, not irregular stuff, but there was a lot to deal with at times for him. And to be fair to him, you just go out and do your bit, do your utmost, because it's not his fault, you know. And you just want to train, you want to work hard, and that was about it, really. And we just sort of, with him, we just cracked on. But you know, keep your counsel, keep your head down whilst you're training, and just crack on through, because, like you say, you just don't know what's around the corner.
To finish on your time at QPR, you did, after the whole Julio Cesar thing, you eventually got back into the side. Like you said, Harry Redknapp came in. You came back up via the playoffs under Harry Redknapp. You played solidly back in the Premier League and then started the next season, but didn't finish it. Now, this is another one I'm fascinated by, because Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink took over and you had to stop playing after, what, 24 games to avoid a clause in your contract?
Yeah, so... We went down. Harry was, you know, we were at Anfield. Harry, I think it was one of the last games. Harry turned to me and we were in the dressing room on our own. And Harry was really good with me. He was great. He was sort of, I think he viewed me as one of the guys he could trust out of a dressing room full of people that he couldn't trust. And sort of would say, well, what do you want to do next season, Rob? I said, well, I'll stay if you'll stay. And he said, like, you know, one of those. And we obviously scraped up on that. That was a really tough season, but that was one of my best seasons, that I think, playing in back in the Championship. But with QPR, we went up. We had a solid defensive partnership with Clint Hill and Richard Dunn and myself, and we won a record amount of games, 1-0 with Charlie Austin scoring. It was bonkers, you know. And we won the playoff final 1-0 with obviously Bobby scoring the winner in the last minute. But, and then, yeah, the next season, I thought, again, was really tough. We got relegated. We never really gave ourselves a chance. Harry sort of saw what was happening, saw that the belt was being tightened, and in his own enigmatic way, he decided to sort of wait until after the end of the transfer window and then resign and say, yeah, okay, if you want to mess around with me over transfers and stuff like that. And I made one or two mistakes in that season as we went down, which cost us, I remember one at Chelsea, home to Chelsea, which we were drawing and we lost because I miskicked a ball, and just one or two things. But overall, the amount of workload that I had in a season, you know, everybody within the club was like, honestly, you've played about 5 seasons within this one season. You know, so it was inevitable. But yeah, that next season, West Ham were came back in for me. I agreed to leave. I said I've signed on a free. I'm saving you, you know, this year's money and next year's money when I play X amount of games, because I've already told you want me to stay. You know, I'm going to leave. I'll walk away. I won't ask for any money off you. Contract will just scratch it off. I'll just go. I don't care. You know, I feel like, you know, it's probably best for the club. And it got to the weekend before the transfer window, and Chris Ramsey was like, you're not leaving. You're not leaving. And I think we got to payday, or I can't remember what had happened. And there was three players who were due to leave or were in talks to leave. And it was Matt Phillips, myself and Charlie. And they wouldn't pay three of us. And you sort of there go, and the manager's telling you one thing, you're not getting paid for another. And we're like, whoa, come on, this is bang out of order. Like, what's going on? And we played Wolves on a midweek night, and we played the game we won at Wolves, and I was in Molineux in the director's box with Les Ferdinand and Ruben, one of the owners, not Tony Fernandez, the other one, and said, look, this deal sat waiting for me to happen. West Ham are phoning me up on a daily basis saying, where are you? My understanding is you're going to let me go. I know the manager says one thing, but you're saying another, and all this sort of stuff. And I said, look, if I get to 30 games, you're going to have to give me a new contract, and you're trying to tighten the belt. And, you know, I'm one of the highest earners. Just call it quits and we're fine. You know, let's go. And the owner turned to us and says, you bullying me? Sorry, what? And I looked at Les, and Les was like, what? He says, and he went into one at us. You know, I got bullied as a child. I'm not getting bullied again, rah, rah, rah. And whether it was an act or whatever, you just sat there and I'm like, I've just played a game for you and won. You know, I didn't have to. Anyway, I went back and I said, Les, what do I do? And he said, do the medical tomorrow. So I did the medical for West Ham the next day. And I woke up and I had sort of 15 messages from Tony Fernandez, who was in the Far East and in Asia. And it was sort of waking up going, hold on a minute, what's going on, all this stuff. And he said, out of all the clubs in the world, I'd never sell you back to them because of what the owners have said about me. And I was like, right, okay. We'll offer you a 3-year deal. We'll do this. We'll do that. Right. Fine. So long and short of it being, Neil Warnock came in after Chris Ramsey got the sack, and first day he came in, he said to us, Rob, this is about October time. We were about 15 games into the season. He says, Rob, you realize you're never going to play 30 games. That was the first thing he said to us. He said, you know, they're not going to get you triggered that clause. So it's like, thank you. Someone's finally been honest, sort of thing. And he was only in a caretaker charge. And I really enjoyed playing under him. And whether you like him or loathe him, I didn't like playing against him. But then when you play for him, as people say, you learn that you realise that they're actually really good to play for. And he was great. And I didn't sort of on a professional level, didn't see eye to eye with Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank. He sort of would question me a lot as a goalkeeper on very, very basic things, and you're thinking, I'm 34, 35 years old, I've played 600-700 games of football, you know, and he's there going, when the ball goes up the pitch and we attack, I need you up the pitch. And not saying it in a way that is kind of that sort of, you know this, but he was saying it as though it was the first time I've been told that. And he just sat there, okay. And then there was one game where he said, I think we conceded in the last minute against Huddersfield. And Naki Wells took a free kick and it went in off the post. And I went over and dived full stretch, got half a fingertip onto it. It hit the post, hit me on back on the hand and went in. Or it just one of them would do better than, you know, but it was bang up against the post. And I walked in and he went, you were too close to the line. You should have been further off the line. And I was like, what? And this is immediately after the game. And you sat there going, what are you talking about? So I went home and I went and got stills of all the top goalkeepers in the world and where they stand for free kicks. And I walked in the next day in training and went, there you go. That's why I stand where I stand. You can tell me where to stand, he said. I said, but there's Buffon, there's Neuer, there's Joe Hart, there's Casilla, there's whoever else it was. I said, that's who I've learned off, these guys, my peers. And he said, well, my belief is you should stand further out. I was like, well, you know, that this is one of them things we're just going to have to disagree on. And it didn't get unsavory. It wasn't a blazing row, but he just sat there in pure frustration, A, from losing the game, or not losing the game, drawing the game away from a winning position the day before to, you know, this sort of situation. And I walked out and I said, this is bonkers. And, you know, and I'd started getting changed for training or whatever it was and got called back into the manager's office. And they said, oh, by the way, nothing to do with that argument, but I think I should tell you now that you're not going to play anymore. Or I need you to play two more games and then you can leave. And, or sit down. And I just said, well, I don't understand. Anyway, I was ill on the following weekend for the FA Cup and didn't play. And that was it. I never played again, you know. And the irony being that whilst the owner was saying to me, you're bullying me, he turned to me and said, if you refuse to play, in this was in August time, then I'll sit you in the stand for the rest of your career. And you just kind of sit there, well, older than me, you've just done that anyway. So that's what I'm saying. So, yeah, it's the things that the conversations you have in football clubs that no one sees and the dynamics that, you know, as of Neil Warnock walking into the building, the irony being that he was really good to me is that I didn't have a future at the club. But I still, you know, they still want me to go out and play.
Crazy, crazy situation. And listen, you were out of the game for a bit, obviously not being able to play towards the end of the season. You moved to Leeds that summer. Typically, I think QPR was your first game, which is just the brilliant irony of football, I think. But
wonderful.
You also, how was that, I suppose, for you, actually? It was probably pretty nice to play against them in your first game.
Now we got stuffed. we got 3-0. Yeah, it was awful. But the mad thing, what they started like, we had a very different proposition at Leeds where we had a young team, we had a manager coming in, a very short pre-season. It was, Leeds was sort of perennially unstable. It was a sort of 45th manager in 6 months or whatever it was that they churn them out at. And we were never going to be ready, but QPR played something like 12 pre-season games. And they just steamrolled us because it was like me having a marathon with Mo Farah or something like that. You know, it was just, and you say, well, let's see where everyone is at Christmas because this is a marathon, not a sprint. And Mo Farah is a good choice. And so that was tough, that game. And it was one that, you know, you let goals in, you're going to face criticism or whatever. And Leeds is a huge club. And you walk in, the first game you lose is 3-0. You think, right, this is going to be an uphill battle because it could be a tough season. You know, we're trying to build something new. But as it transpired, you know, again, you operate under good partnerships and good understandings. We had Carl Bartley, we had Pontus Janssen, Liam Cooper came in and out. But, you know, it was a fairly steady back four there that was the basis of the success. And I really enjoyed that season and really enjoyed playing under Gary Monk because he kept it simple and he sort of, you see the tools that you've got within the team. You know, the kind of the opposite of being at QPR where you sort of feather in these guys from all over the world. You've got this group of players. We had 15, 16 players that really you could pick from. And you're going in sort of playing a 50-odd game season. Got to the quarterfinals of the League Cup or whatever it was. And you're off the back of that saying, we just ran out of legs that season. We just, you know, it was one of the most enjoyable seasons I've had because there was no expectations or it sort of people had us down to go down. But actually we did better than everyone expected. And it was a real blow when the new owner came in, sort of had different ideas to the manager and the manager left and then evidently it was sort of different ideas for me as well. So these are one of the things that happen in football.
just want to touch on that because you mentioned Gary Monk there and you mentioned Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink before that. When it comes to the relationship between goalkeeper and manager, it's one that always fascinates me because more often than not, apart from our friend at Wolves, obviously was previously a goalkeeper, most managers were previously outfield players. So when you get a situation like that, and I, again, I say this because personally I struggled a bit with this when I was given advice by a manager on something that was very goalkeeping specific. And as you mentioned, you a lot more so than me, where it's something you've invested your life in for 30 odd years and you're being told by a manager, it for me, that always felt a bit strange and I found it quite difficult to deal with. But it sounds like you've got a variety of different relationships. You mentioned the one with Gary Monk that was very good. Was that a case of him kind of leaving you be, or what did you consider the ideal dynamic? Was it more so where they're feeding stuff back via a goalkeeper coach? How did it work best for you?
Inevitably, I think, well, in a literal sense, being a manager is you manage your staff. And, you know, that goes with the coaches as well as the, you know, that is, you are the manager and you have a specialist in that department. And you have a goalkeeper coach, if you're fortunate enough to be at a club where there is a goalkeeper coach. You know, you sit there and you say, well, the best managers I've worked under, I think I had Mike Walker when I first started. He was a goalkeeper. Yeah. And, you know, the best ones, Nigel Worthington, I love playing under. He said, don't understand it. I've got a goalkeeper coach. If I need to understand something, I'll speak to him. If I then disagree, we'll disagree. But that's my filter. And, you know, Gary Monk was come and chat to us. We were virtually the same age. You know, it was kind of like we'd sort of gone through the same era of football. And he would speak to Flabs, was a goalkeper coach for Darrell Five, and who was great. It was his first year as a goalkeeper coach, and he was learning on the spot, and he had ideas and new ideas and new stuff to work on. It was just enjoyable because you got left to it. And I turn around and say, look, I'm 36. I've made as many mistakes as anybody else and learnt as much as anybody else. So, and I think the manager appreciated that. And he sort of, that's why I came in. You know, it was because we had a young team. We needed someone, a steady head, just to not dictate, but to be that sort of, that person in between the dressing room and the manager's office and stuff like that to say, well, this is why this is, you know, and I think it worked well. But like you say, yeah, in short, it was one that when they use the goalkeeper coach and you use your staff as a filter and also you trust your staff. I mean, whereas when the managers are hands on, you look at the goalkeeper coach and you're thinking, other than a ball server, what are you doing? You know, not, you know, and they're thinking the same thing. They're looking at you going, sorry, mate. Like there's nothing I can do here. This is my boss who's battering you for something that I don't agree with either. So it's tough in that regard.
Okay, so don't panic. We have stopped the interview there. That's because it ran for longer than we thought. Again, just like last time, to be fair, we cut it. Actually, no, not like last time. Last time, we weren't able to do enough, so we cut it at one half. We then planned to do a second half, but we got into such dialogue with Rob Green. Brilliant storyteller, isn't he? Really, really good storyteller. So what we're going to do, Rich, is our first half, our second half, and then in a week's time, you're going to get Rob Green extra time where he talks about England, where he talks about Chelsea and a few other bits and pieces. We're really riding this one until the wheels come off.
We're making the most of our Rob Green content, absolutely. But it was fascinating. The QPR, I know we're going to go into a bit of detail on QPR, but just extraordinary.
Yeah, amazing, really, when you think about it. And I know that you said you went through something similar at Brentford with Ben Hamer and Andy Scott, I think, was the manager at the time. You went in and had a blazing row. He found out about Julio Cesar just shortly after he'd signed for QPR when he was on his way to a game. And he went into the guys and said, why have you signed me? Let me go. Like, let me leave. And they wouldn't let it. Just a crazy situation.
It's something that I think not a lot of people will fully understand about football, the politics in football. And a lot of the things that you know, ordinarily you'll see a team sheet, you expect to see certain names on the team sheet, and you think it's as simple as that, but it isn't. Football is a business, which a lot of us do understand now, and behind that, there's so much that goes on. You know, my story in particular, and the reason I was frustrated is that you're sold something. When you go to a club, you will often meet the manager, and they will paint a picture for you, and you buy into that picture, and you believe that to be true. But of course, effectively, they're a salesman in that particular situation where all they want is for you to sign on the dotted line. The moment you've signed, to be honest, once you've got a contract, there's not a great deal in it that protects you for something like what happened to Rob Green. And unfortunately, you know, he has signed the contract he signed. As soon as that then happens, it's not the situation he saw himself being in. And it can really impact certain careers. Now, thankfully for Rob Green, we know what happened thereafter. He ends up having a fantastic career. But so many players are in a similar situation, and it doesn't end quite so positively for them.
A real lesson as well, the fact that he just said, I just got my head down. I just got my head down. And he understood, you know, and maybe that's because he was an experienced goalkeeper at the time, but he understood that there was nothing he could do. And we said, you know, what did you say to Mark Hughes? Did you go in? Did you have a row? Did you have a conversation? He said, no point. Absolutely no point, because Mark Hughes would have just turned around and gone, yeah, it's rubbish, isn't it? On you go.
And that's it. And this is where credit to him, because by the way, I didn't do that in my situation. The moment I found out, maybe it was slightly different for me. I was actually doing a warm-up and I found out from somebody in the warm-up. And so I've gone back in literally minutes before this game was about to start that I was playing in, because I'd heard that we were signing Ben Hamer the day after, and just had a break blazing around with the manager there and then, because it was just the fact, again, it goes back to just being lied to. You know, it's as simple as that. It's just a, you know, a human thing. It's nothing to do with football anymore. It's just, you've lied to me. And it's as difficult as that. But then I think, credit to him, he dealt with it exactly as I would now tell other professionals to deal with something like that. But ultimately, all you can do is focus on yourself, is focus on your game, is make sure you're turning up and you're doing the best you possibly can for yourself, because at some point the situation will change. Maybe not immediately, but at some point it will change. And if you've spent months being upset with the club as to the situation they put you in and the fact that they haven't been honest with you, then it's only going to impact you further down the line. So huge credit to him that he's able to keep his head in the way that he did, because, mentioned, you know, I certainly would have struggled with that, I think, in that situation.
And he just wanted that honesty as well, which, and listen, yeah, say what you like about Harry Redknapp and Neil Warnock, but he said, when they came in, they were just real with me. They were honest. They told me the situation. Neil Warnock, when he came back to QPR in caretaker charge, after Rob had signed that extended deal, after the debacle with the owner who said that he was bullying him and he was bullied as a child, and he had this clause in his contract that if he played 30 games, they're going to have to pay him more money. And Neil Warnock said, Rob, you're not going to get that many games, mate. You're not going to get that many games. Just an FYI, think about your future. And he said, at last, some honesty. That's all I wanted.
And it's something that I've learned in, I say later life, makes me sound old, but certainly as I went through my football career, was a realization that actually a lot of what's being said to you is simply a negotiation tactic. So I can't help but feel that everything that was being said, the kind of victim mentality, the poor me, was ultimately a negotiation tactic to maybe get himself out of that. Because ultimately, further down the line, the proof is always going to be in the pudding. And from his point of view, they weren't true to what they said. And again, it's like frustration after frustration. It must have been so difficult. So then to have a manager to come in and actually just tell you it as it is, that's all players ask for. That's all you ever ask for. And unfortunately, it's never quite that simple. And it certainly wasn't in his case.
I wonder if West Ham fans know that as well. I didn't know that he was so close to going back shortly after he'd left, and then he talked to them again a bit later on about going back to West Ham. All these stories, like you said, that you never know what's going on behind the scenes. As it turns out, he went on to Leeds United, had a really good season at Leeds United, which is where we then cut it off. We've got Huddersfield to come, we've got Chelsea to come, and more importantly, we've got England to come. It's worth saying at this juncture, we've already had the discussion with Rob Green, we've had the chat, we're going to give you that extra time installment next week, and it's good. Some good content in there.
Yeah, it really is. Now, certainly when he goes quite deep, doesn't he? It's the England stuff, which I was wondering how deep he would go, but no, fascinating insight.
Good stuff. Richard, another one down.
Thank you, as always.
This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. We'll see you next time.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's M-O-O-D.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to Mood.com, that's M-O-O-D.com, to get started.